So, good night. Again, Dekka reached for the door, and when Green didn't move aside, a hard look came over Dekka's face. Peeks leaned into her, to an intimate distance, an uncomfortable distance that conveyed just the hint of threat. We need one of you. Preferably, you. But if you refuse, our next stop is Sam Temple, and I think we both know he'll agree to help us. Hey, Sam's sober, and Astrid's got her head screwed on straight, so leave them the hell out of this. Leave them both alone. Peeks met her gaze, unflinching, and Dekka sighed. Ah, so it's like that. She shook her head, realizing she was trapped. You have any idea how many times that boy, that man, saved my life? Many times. Peeks again, and now the pitch was lower, lending an almost compassionate tone. I've read all the published stories, Miss Talent, and many unpublished statements. So I know as well that you saved him. Many times. I know that you were his strong right arm whenever things turned dangerous. Then Green spoke up, sounding disapproving. You're a lesbian, and black, and yet you're inevitably referred to as the strong right arm to a white male. Doesn't that grate on your nerves? Aren't we supposed to be past that? Dekka let go a snort and sat all the way back in her seat, willing herself to remain calm. A white male? She echoed, her voice vibrating with suppressed anger. He's not a white male. He's Sam freaking Temple. You can read all the accounts you want, but you don't know what he did and how... Tears threatened to well again. Dekka stabbed a finger at Green. Every single person, every single one who came out of that hellhole alive is alive because of him. Sam Temple's strong right arm? You could chisel those words on my tombstone, lady, and I'll be a proud and happy corpse. We'd rather have you, Peeks said, and took Green's phone and held it out for Dekka. The document glowed up at her. Press your thumb on the button. Dekka did it, because if she didn't, Sam would. He would, of course, be furious if he found out she was protecting him. The thought brought a small smile to Dekka's lips. Sam and Astrid didn't need more of the phase. They needed college and work and lives and hopefully, someday, a bouncing little baby that they'd named Dekka, if she was a girl. That was Dekka's fantasy for them, anyway. Am I going back to work tomorrow? She asked. Tom Peeks shook his head. Dekka unclipped the name tag with her cover name, Jean, her middle name, reached across, rolled down the window, and tossed the tag out to clatter on the blacktop. Wherever you're taking me, my bike had better get there too, and without a scratch. Oh, and fill the tank. ASO 2 Anomalous Space Object 2 struck planet Earth after its million-year trip, landing precisely where it was expected to land, in a section of the North Sea, just off the coast of Scotland, that had been surrounded by NATO ships, American, British, and Dutch. Below the water, one British and one U.S. submarine were holding the perimeter around a French deep-sea exploration submersible. Ships from the Russian Navy and the Chinese Navy looked on from a barely discreet distance, their surveillance equipment all a-tingle. But the meteorite played a trick on all of them. The 17-pound object hit perfectly in the target zone, moving at about 90,000 miles an hour, but like a rock slung sidearm toward a pond, it skipped. The first skip carried it 6 miles. The second skip carried it just 2 miles, but that 2 miles took it to the Isle of Isla, where it struck a rock outcropping, still moving at fantastic speed, and broke apart. Homeland Security Task Force 66 immediately diverted every resource at its disposal. The International Naval Force and their Marines, land-based police and military forces, and turned the sleepy Isle of Isla, pronounced Isla, and best known for sheep and Scotch whiskey, into something between a war zone and a bad action comedy. Within an hour, the coast of Isla was beset by dangerous-looking ships, while helicopters buzzed around like bees who thought Isla was their hive. All the activity brought the islanders out of their homes and fields and businesses to see what was going on. Once they had deduced that the military and police of several nations were all searching for a meteorite, out came the metal detectors and the sifters and the shovels. The locals might not know what the rock was, but they knew it had value. Yet, it was not greed that caused the biggest problem. Rather, it was kindness. It was young Delia Macbeth, 14, who saw her little brother Sean, just 4 years old, playing with a chip of dark rock. The chip was oddly shaped, in that if you held it a certain way, it looked a bit like Mickey Mouse. Sean was sucking on the rock, and at first Delia did the proper big sister thing and took it from him. Then Sean started bawling, so Delia did the easy thing and gave it back. After all, it was just a rock, and if Sean wanted it that badly... Search teams swept the lower half of the island and eventually recovered 60% of ASO2. 60%. The other 40% was scattered across fields and woods, and about 3 ounces of it was in the greedy fist and slavering mouth of a 4-year-old with a notoriously bad temper. Chapter 3. The Committing of Crimes. Days passed, homework was done, school was attended, but school had ceased to be the center of Cruz's life. They had dinner once with Shade's father, Professor Martin Darby, just back from Scotland. He was a good-looking man, a silver fox type, formal by nature but trying to be accessible. "Please, call me Darby. Everyone does." He tried to play the cool dad, but his interest and attention were elsewhere. He seemed overly formal with Shade, and she returned it in kind. Not that there was any hostility. On the contrary, the affection and mutual respect were clear, and something Cruz envied terribly. But Professor Darby's mind was not on his daughter, let alone his daughter's new friend, who, even a distracted astrophysicist had figured out, was not a boyfriend. Above all, Shade and Cruz planned. Which was to say, Shade planned with ferocious efficiency and relentless logic, as it began to dawn on Cruz that while the scheme might seem wildly improbable, even impossible, it was no such thing for her impressive new friend. Cruz had never met anyone like Shade, not even a little like Shade. It was as if there were two people living in that pretty scarred body, a high school science nerd and a shark. Sometimes Cruz played a little game with herself, seeing Shade's unblemished left side as representing an interesting but essentially normal high school girl, and the right side, the side with the scar, as the shark. The girl Shade Darby was funny and relaxed, and even moderately empathetic. The predatory fish? Well, as the movie line went, the shark had lifeless eyes, black eyes. Like a doll's eyes. Yes, there were times when Shade frightened Cruz a little, but that frisson, that sense that she was dealing with a person far larger than could possibly fit within this girl, just added to Cruz's growing infatuation. Writers, even unpublished ones, loved characters, and Shade Darby was definitely a character. Was it the shark that kept Cruz from asking Shade why she was doing this? Was it the invisible but very real barrier that Shade erected around that question and around her past? At the very least, Cruz wanted to ask about the scar. It was not subtle. It was like something out of an old Frankenstein movie, a good 6 inches long and cross-hatched. Shade could have worn her hair in such a way as to hide it, but she didn't. She could have worn turtlenecks, but she didn't. She wore the scar proudly, it seemed to Cruz. Or was the right word, defiantly. It had the odd effect of accentuating her prettiness, but at the same time, it gave her an aura of toughness and mystery. "I don't want to push her. I don't want to lose her." Cruz had thus far in her writing life stuck to short stories and the occasional bit of not great poetry. But she had enough of the instincts of a writer to recognize that here was a story. Maybe a cautionary tale of obsession. Maybe a weepy rise above it tale in which Shade coped with the death of one parent and the emotional absence of the other. But that was certainly not how Shade saw herself. And when Cruz was with Shade, she could not help being swept up in Shade's determination. Shade was like an ebb tide, sweeping Cruz out to sea, out to danger. And yet, you are willing to be swept, Cruz. Aimless and friendless, you are just so much flotsam on the river of life. One thing had become clear. There was no more harassment from anyone at school. And somehow, this was Shade's doing. Though Cruz had no notion of how her friend managed it. The student body simply seemed to have figured out that Cruz was under Shade's protection, and that was all it took. Cruz did not become popular overnight. In fact, if anything, she felt people avoiding her, but they did not hassle her, and for now, that was enough. Cruz sometimes wondered what Shade was like before losing her mother. Had she always had this split personality? Had she always had a gift for ruthlessness and the iron will to go with it? Had she ever just been a normal high school girl? Did whatever it was that took her mother's life harden her? And was it the kind of hard that was only on the outside, or did it go all the way down? Cruz had covered pages of her purple moleskin with notes about her new friend. Her only friend. She had started by thinking Shade's plan to steal the rock was fantasy, the kind of desperate nonsense a girl with delusions of grandeur or a simple hunger for adventure might come up with. That mistaken belief lasted only a very short while, for it was clear, absolutely unmistakably clear, that Shade Darby meant to steal the rock, that she meant to experiment with the rock. And though Shade never quite said it, Cruz knew it was all connected to the absent, never mentioned, but always somehow present, Dr. Heather Darby, Ph.D. Then, too suddenly, the date came. ASO3 was on its long glide path to Earth, orbiting once before it would begin its tumble into the atmosphere, and by then, whatever doubts Cruz had became irrelevant, because the line was before them, and both girls knew they were going to cross it. Shade drove a dull but sensible Subaru, a few years old, clean inside and out, in a color that could best be described as forgettable beige. It was so at odds with Shade's personality that Cruz guessed it had been Shade's mother's car. Cruz herself did not drive. She could have. She could easily pass the test. But she was not yet ready to face the trauma of something that was simple for everyone else, answering the question, male or female. Yes or no, up or down, in or out, male or female, and no, there could be nothing that did not fit into a binary. Either slash or. Not some of this and some of that. Where's my phone? Cruz asked in sudden consternation, patting various areas of her body before vaguely remembering she'd left it in Shade's room. I took it, Shade said. Look in that bag by your feet. There are two burner phones in there. Cruz looked as Shade pulled out of the driveway and turned in the direction of the freeway. These are crap. These aren't even smartphones. Cell phones, especially smartphones, are tracking devices, Shade said, distracted by traffic. They leave a record of your movements. First thing 66 will do when they see they've been robbed is look for cell phone signatures at the crash site. It wouldn't be hard to connect my cell phone to my father, and burners aren't not exactly iPhones. We did discuss this, Cruz. A heavy sigh. I just didn't think you meant it. We're practically cave people now. I'm going to go into withdrawal. Cruz pulled out her moleskin and a pen. What are you writing? I'm writing that a monster has kidnapped me and plunged me back into the 20th century. I thought writers enjoyed the chance to write, free of distractions. A car sliced too close to their front bumper, and Shade leaned on the horn. Hey, asshole! Cruz did her silent laugh, and for a while was lost to conversation, bent over her notebook, pen held in her left hand in an awkward-looking position. You stick your tongue out when you write, Shade observed.
I do not.
You get the tip between your teeth and it sticks out between your lips. Cruz made a rumbling sound of irritation, added a sentence to the moleskin that ended with an unnecessarily emphatic exclamation point, and put her notebook away. You sure your folks won't send cops to look for you? Shade asked.
I'm totally, absolutely, 100% sure, Cruz said grimly, then chided herself.
No, no, don't go to the bitter place. We're having an adventure. We're committing a federal crime.
Yay?
You wouldn't believe how little interest they have in where I am, Cruz said, trying to inject some lightness into her tone.
And your dad? I checked. He's in Nebraska. Cool, calm, unruffled. She must know this will put her father in a bad spot, Cruz thought. But she won't stop. Won't or can't? Obsession? And why am I going along? Am I really this desperate for a friend?
But of course, Cruz knew the answer to that question.
Yes, she was desperate for a friend. Yes, she enjoyed the odd status that came from being associated with Shade at school. But mostly, Cruz admitted, she herself had no goal, no plan, no clear idea of what she wanted to do. And Shade did.
I'm a puppy who hopes Shade will throw a stick I can fetch.
Traffic was awful, as usual in Chicagoland, but in time they emerged from beneath low rain clouds to a sunnier suburbia west of the city, and soon were moving along open interstate, penetrating the vast spaces of the American agricultural heartland. It was autumn, and the corn that extended for hundreds of miles around was being harvested. Giant, insect-like machines, painted red or green, powered slowly but relentlessly, stripping off the ears and leaving forlorn pale yellow stalks and mulch behind.
How long is this drive to hell without apps? Cruz asked.
4.5 hours. You know, Cruz, the human race survived for 1 million years before the first phone, let alone the first app.
Survived, Cruz said, raising a finger. Survived, but it wasn't really living.
We have music. Cruz turned on the stereo and punched buttons until she came to the loaded files. She scrolled through Shade's music, thinking it an opportunity to get some insight into her new friend's soul. She found a number of things she didn't recognize. Experimental music, but also more familiar, reggae, blues, pop, rock, punk, even classical. If there was a coded message in Shade's playlists, the message was that she sampled widely and committed to no particular genre or artist. But there were a few things more accessible.
Seriously? Cruz asked. Beyonce? What else, Taylor Swift?
I suppose you'd like something more cutting edge?
Not really, Cruz admitted.
Luis Malaga? Cantea?
Cruz peered at Shade, waiting for signs of recognition.
Nothing? OV7? Come on, Shade, they've been around forever, she sighed.
What can I say? I moved to the beat from south of the border.
Isn't that all, like, accordions?
I am going to pretend you didn't say that.
To cover the awkwardness, you could put on some of my music, Shade said, batting her eyes.
Cruz had found the right song, the one with the most plays.
Yes, yes, this is definitely Shade Darby, Cruz said, and hit play.
The guitar was twangy, and the voice was thin but strong. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
Cruz sang the refrain with a small adjustment. Hey, Shade will stand her ground, and she won't back down.
It was the shark who cast her a chilly sidelong glance. Shade had a great sense of humor about lots of things, but not as much about references to her interest, to use a kinder word than obsession.
They listened to music for a while until something ska came on, which they both liked, and Cruz began to dance in place.
You're bouncing the whole car, Shade said, sounding like someone's mother.
I know! Help me! Soon the Subaru was bouncing happily as they both danced in place, arms flailing, heads bobbing, shoulders twisting. Shade inevitably more controlled, more contained, less committed to the music than Cruz. But after 3 hours of corn, the occasional freeway off-ramp, and still more unstoppable corn, they were both sick of music, hungry, and needing to pee fairly desperately. They pulled off into a Wendy's. They peed, then ate. A salad and fries for Cruz, who was toying with vegetarianism without quite committing, and a burger for Shade, who had no reluctance to eat animal flesh.
You know, you attack your food, Cruz observed. You cut it in half like you're the perfect little miss, then you go all hungry hippo on it.
Did you just call me a hippo? Bellies full, they set off again, racing now toward the setting sun.
We're getting close,
Cruz indicated the GPS with her chin.
We're there, basically.
Shade switched to her instructional voice. A degree of latitude is about 70 miles. A minute is a little over a mile, and a second of latitude is, give or take, 100 feet. It works a bit differently with longitude, but if the calculations are correct, we're looking for a rectangle about 100 feet by 80 feet.
Ladies and gentlemen, the human Wikipedia, Wikishade.
Shade pulled over onto the shoulder of the road, corn to their right, a fallow field of rich, black Iowa topsoil across the road to their left. Shade pulled a smaller, portable GPS unit from her bag. This will get us down to the seconds. She booted up the portable GPS device, and while she waited for it, she deleted their destination from the car's GPS.
You're kind of getting into this whole spy cloak and dagger stuff, aren't you?
Cruz teased.
I kind of am,
Shade admitted, allowing herself a rare grin at her own expense. The handheld GPS booted up, and after a moment's peering and muttering, Shade said,
Okay, we go down that dirt road, go half a mile, and it shouldn't be far.
The sun was setting as they parked beside a wooden gate wide enough to admit trucks and harvesting combines. In fact, there was a green John Deere combine parked maybe 200 yards away, looking like some fantastic alien monster turned in for the night.
Lucky timing, Shade said. Late enough the farmers won't be working out here, and just an hour and a half to go.
An hour and a half? Cruz whined. People could be talking about me online, and I wouldn't even know.
And somehow, you actually think that's a bad thing.
As early autumn darkness fell, they sat staring at the impact site. What Shade hoped and Cruz feared was the impact site. Just an abstract rectangle within the larger rectangle of the unharvested cornfield. Cruz still harbored the secret hope that this was a wild goose chase, that Shade had made an error, and the rock was going to land safely in Nebraska, or somewhere. But at the same time, despite her greater caution, Cruz had a second level of thought that whispered, It would be interesting, though, wouldn't it? As if sensing Cruz's ambivalence, Shade reached across to squeeze Cruz's hand, something she had never done before. It was a little awkward, and at first it seemed forced or calculated, and with Shade you could never be sure. But Cruz squeezed back, and they held that pose for a minute.
We are about to commit a felony, Cruz reflected, and all I'm thinking about is how that gesture is a girl-girl thing. How needy am I?
They sat in companionable silence as the sun disappeared and navy blue darkness stole over the field. The windows were down. It was not quite warm, but not cold, either. And they heard a whole world of insect life, buzzing, droning, rising and falling like a stadium full of bugs doing the wave. High above, a jet drew a coral line across the sky, picking up the sun's dying brilliance.
I hate to say it, but this is more fun than I've had in years, Cruz said.
I hate to say it, but me too.
If we don't get arrested,
Cruz added. 10 minutes. What if the calculations are off? Then it won't hit here. It will smash into some other field, maybe even a town. Could be miles away, could be on another continent. Shade touched the scar on her neck, drawing a finger along it, feeling the raised flesh, feeling the cross-hatching of the stitches. Cruz had noticed the gesture before, as she had noticed the faraway look that came with it. They tried to stay cool and nonchalant, but the tension rose minute by minute. They made small talk, but it was pitiful, distracted stuff. They would start in on some teacher and lose the thread. They would start again on some fashion or celebrity, and again, lose the thread. Cruz asked her to dish on Malik. Nope. Still, she did not ask the question her mind was screaming at her. Why are you doing this, Shade? What is the connection to the scar? This probably won't work. Not without the dome, Shade said. It was the first negative thing she'd said, the first expression of doubt, and that tiny admission of worry, of fear, of vulnerability, added new layers to Cruz's affection. Shade might be tough, determined, and at times perfectly ruthless, but there was a human in there. Or it will work, Cruz said. In fact, I bet it does. Hope is the best form of torture, Shade said dryly. There was a persistent lump in Cruz's throat that she could not swallow away. 3 minutes, Shade said, and there again Cruz saw the predator, the focus, the fearlessness, the hunger. No more stroking of scars, no more dreamy, faraway look. Cruz felt herself teetering on the edge between hope and fear. That nervousness finally gave her the courage to ask. In a rush, she blurted, Shade, why are we doing this? Shade sighed and looked out through the windshield, more profile than detail in the gathering gloom. Finally, she said, like the man who climbed Mount Everest, Cruz. Because it's there. What's there? Shade turned to look at her friend. The shark looked, too. Okay, you have a right to know. I was there the day the PBA barrier came down. I was right there, inches away. I saw that creature, the one they called Gaia. I saw what she did. It was awful. The worst thing I've ever seen. You have no idea. People, little kids, cut up like pigs at a butcher shop. But the power? It was like watching a god, Cruz. Then after a beat, she pointed at the scar. It's where I got this. A scared little girl with a great big knife. Cruz, confused and alarmed, said, Wait, Gaia was evil, not a god? They won't be able to capture all the ASOs, Cruz. And if the rock has the same effects outside the dome, well, the world may be about to become a very strange place. A very, very strange place. And what I saw that day, well, no one could stop that monster. No one could stop her but someone with an even greater power. Gods aren't always good or kind. Some are monsters. I'm not, if it works, there will be other monsters, Cruz. Other Gaias. And more people will be hurt. More people... And for a moment, Shade seemed unable to go on. Then, her voice abruptly steely, she said, 30 seconds. No, Cruz thought. That wasn't quite the whole truth. It was related to the truth, but it was just the story Shade told herself. Time, Shade announced, tension almost choking the word off. 10, 9, 8. I hope this works for you, Shade. I know, Cruz. 4, 3. And there it was in the night sky to their left. A spark, not very bright, like someone tracing a laser pointer across the sky. It was a tiny missile. The estimate was 4 kilos, just under 10 pounds, moving at thousands of miles an hour, a shooting star come to bring them hope, or to dash that hope. 2, for the first time since Cruz was a very little child, she wished upon a shooting star. 1, Shade whispered, and the meteorite hit the ground. There was no explosion, just a dull, flat sound, like someone dropping a big sandbag. A puff of gray dust rose, barely visible in the darkness, but just exactly where Shade expected it to land. Wow, Cruz said. Shade agreed. Her casual act was not even slightly believable.
They took a breath, then all at once piled out of the car.
Cruz pulled a shovel from the back and raced to catch up to Shade, who was galloping ahead. The ground was plowed into furrows that tripped Cruz repeatedly, and, too, there were the 6-foot-tall stalks that snatched at her with Velcro talons and slapped her with heavy ears of corn. They came to a halt when they reached the first charred and broken corn stalks and advanced more slowly after that, as if sneaking up on someone. And suddenly, there it was, looking for all the world as if a rogue tractor had come through dragging a narrow plow. The rich black earth was gouged, with a mound of ejected clods marking the spot where the rock went subterranean. "There, dig, there," Shade ordered. Cruz dug and dug. She uncovered a narrow tunnel like something a hefty gopher might have made. "Go that direction another 10 feet, Shade instructed, her voice ragged, in tenuous control of her emotions. And then, as Cruz slammed the blade into the ground, they heard the metallic impact of steel shovel on rock. They looked at each other, Shade and Cruz, and time seemed to stop. "Okay," Shade said, at last, voice quavering. "Dig it up." It was gray, the color of pencil lead, not much bigger than a softball, but more oval than round, with a pitted surface. To every appearance, a regular unimportant meteorite, like thousands that impact the earth every day. Shade flicked the flashlight off, and they were rewarded by a faint but vaguely sinister glow, slightly green. Shade reached for it. "Don't touch it!" Cruz cried. "It's probably hot." "Actually, it's more likely to be cold. It was a long, long time in absolute zero, and it spent just seconds in the atmosphere." Cruz shook her head in rueful amusement. "Of course Shade would have thought of that. Of course." Shade touched the rock, touched it with the solemnity of a medieval Christian pilgrim touching a piece of the true cross. Shade ran her fingers over it, feeling its contours, gently exploring the pits and cracks, brushing dirt away almost tenderly. "This is it," she said. "I can't believe..." "We should probably get out of here," Cruz said nervously. She carried the rock on the shovel blade back to the Subaru, while Shade used corn stalks to obscure their tracks. Cruz set the rock in the back of the car. Then, feeling transgressive, feeling that it wasn't her right somehow, Cruz touched it, touched an object that had traveled an unimaginable distance. It was just a rock, really, just a faintly glowing rock. But it had a power Cruz could feel, an attraction. "Frodo and the ring," Cruz thought, and laughed nervously at the comparison, because the thought came with an extra question. Is Shade Frodo, or is she Gollum? "It won't take 66 long to get here," Shade said, brushing dirt from the knees of her jeans and kicking the clods from her shoes. "We can't hide the fact we beat them to it, but we can confuse the scene a little at least." "Not much we could do about the tire tracks, I guess." "No," Shade agreed. "But as soon as we get back to the interstate, we're going to cut a divot into one of the tires, just enough that if anyone ever checks, it won't be a perfect match." "Have you been watching CSI reruns?" "I may be a criminal mastermind." Cruz said nothing. Shade started the engine, and then they stopped for just a moment, staring at each other with solemn expressions. "Wow, we did it," Cruz said. "Well," Shade said, "we did the first part of it." Chapter 4. Bad Start, Worse Finish. The Subaru, driven by Shade and Cruz, pulled away, and the young man climbed from the cabin of the parked green John Deere combine, where he'd been waiting and watching. Justin Devere turned to his girlfriend, Erin O'Day, and as he gave her his hand to help her climb down, not easy in the entirely inappropriate, skin-tight dress she was wearing, he said, "I wonder if I should have killed them and taken it." Justin Devere was 19, but already in his junior year at Columbia, where he studied art, but was not much of a student. He could paint or sculpt or assemble whatever he liked, and so overawe his professors that they would hand him A's merely for showing up. He was, people said, a prodigy. He was, people said, a young Picasso or Rothko. He was on the verge of becoming the next big thing in the art world. Justin Devere was brilliant and utterly devoid of a moral center, extremely talented, sociopathic, and maladjusted, a loner, an outsider, a predator awaiting the right prey. Those were not the things Justin's enemies said. It was what he knew about himself. Justin had taken IQ tests, 152, which made him smarter than 99.9% of humanity. He had also taken the so-called psychopath test and was unmistakably a member of that manipulative, ruthless, often charming tribe. A brilliant psychopath. A talented psychopath. A young monster. That was how Justin Devere saw himself, how he knew himself to be. A brilliant, talented monster. But he was no monster to look at, and he was quite aware of that as well. Justin always managed to look the part of the young artist, dressing in skin-tight black jeans and a series of t-shirts on which he silkscreened bits of text in cuneiform or Sanskrit alphabets. Only he knew that the messages were either some version of F.U. or a sexual reference. He was not big, not as big as he'd have liked anyway, just 5'9", white, with straight black hair worn loose down to his shoulders, pale gray eyes, and, as another artist had once said while attempting unsuccessfully to seduce Justin, the face of God's cruelest angel. Justin's partner for now, Erin O'Day, was 28, mother of a 9-year-old she had shipped off to the very best schools in Switzerland at age 5 and had not seen since. Justin was not supposed to know this about her, but he did. Justin was not a respecter of privacy. Erin was beautiful, sophisticated, fashionable, and sexy, but Justin had never had a problem attracting beautiful women and girls. What made Erin O'Day special was that she was the heir to a fortune estimated by Forbes magazine at $300 million. Sexy women Justin could find any day. $300 million? That was quite rare. Erin was part of New York society, moving effortlessly through glittering events, including the endless charity balls where she promoted young Justin. It was at one of these balls that she met Professor Martin Darby, who had been drinking and talking more than he should have. He had told her about tracking the anomalous space objects and hinted that his work was top secret. It never ceased to amaze Justin just what Erin could get away with merely by being blonde, beautiful, and poured into a dress with a plunging neckline, all, of course, enhanced by the kind of jewelry and fashion that screamed money. According to Erin, the professor had lost his wife and was clearly lonely for female companionship, and, again, according to Erin, he didn't get anything beyond some drinks and a dance or two. Erin had had no real notion of what to do with the information, but Justin did. Justin had a friend who had a friend who was a serious hacker, and for just $500 of Erin's money, Justin gained access to Martin Darby's computer and learned the secrets of the anomalous space objects. Justin stood now gazing thoughtfully at the field, tilting his head, making slight adjusting motions with his hands, imagining a murder scene. Playing the part, pretending to actually think he should have killed the two because he knew full well it would turn Erin on. Erin had never known a person who could say, "I wonder if I should have killed them," and mean it. It was viscerally exciting to her. It made her heart run mad and sent chills of fear tingling up her spine. Yes, Justin knew Erin O'Day and how to play her, and he remained faithful to her because while there were plenty of beautiful women in the art world and fewer who were both beautiful and rich, he had met only one who was also excited by the darkness Justin knew lay at his core. "We're in the middle of nowhere," Erin said. She was irritable, not being a fan of cramped, chilly tractor cabins. "Our names are on flights from New York to Des Moines. We've left a trail."
"Speaking of trails," Justin said, "you wrote down their license plate number?"
Erin opened her phone, swiped a few times, and held up a dark photo of an Illinois plate, fuzzy from a distance, but readable. Justin stirred restlessly, stamping his feet to warm himself while still self-consciously gazing at the dark cornfield.
I was just picturing how it would look, you know, when the sun came up, when they were found, blood splatters all over the cornstalks. I'd arranged the bodies so that...
He paused to consider, eyes narrow, hand drawing shapes in the air. I'd make them strip naked first. Just leave one or two random bits. A sock, a scarf, something enigmatic that made it appear to be a clue, then bang, bang. He mimed firing a handgun. No one would ever be able to make sense of it, but there'd be 50 conspiracy theories online in a week, Aaron said. Then, adopting a more mature tone, she added, but that's not why we're here.
Anywhere I am, I'm there for art, Justin said, smirking to take the edge off his pomposity and inwardly rolling his eyes at his own BS. Come on, let's see if they left us anything. Can you go get me the black light from my bag?
In these shoes? With a sigh, Justin fetched the bag, unzipped it, pointed his phone light into the bag, and withdrew a battery-powered wand that shone black, more purple than black, light into the hole he'd widened. Huh, here's a chip right here. He held up a thin, sharp-edged fragment, no more than an inch and a half long and a quarter of an inch thick.
Is that enough?
Who knows? Justin asked.
I guess we'll find out. If it isn't, we'll track the license plates.
What do we do with it? Crush it and snort it?
In the PBA, they were just exposed to the radiation, but I think that's the slow and inefficient way, Justin said.
He frowned.
The bigger question is, where is the team of scientists who were supposed to be here? I was expecting helicopters and big trucks. So, who were those two? How did they get here? What did they take away? And what do they intend to do with it?
That's four questions. Justin checked an app.
There's an early flight to LaGuardia tomorrow morning. We could make it easy.
Or we can make it right here, Aaron said with a leer.
What here?
He asked, faux innocent. I thought we were clear on who's the boss.
Justin grinned up at her and said, yes, ma'am.
He was not in the mood. Not really. Much more interested in the anomalous space object than the predictable female object. But her desire for him and his ability to feed that desire were vital parts of moving large chunks of money from her hands to his. And there were worse ways to pass the time in an Iowa cornfield. Afterward, they walked back to the rental car, concealed off the main road in a little stand of trees. They drove to Des Moines, stopped at a Walmart en route, and checked into the DoubleTree Hotel near the airport. Justin set up the mortar and pestle he'd purchased at the Walmart and ground the rock fragment to a powder. Then he dumped it out onto the nightstand and used a credit card to form the powder into a line about 6 inches long.
Want some?
He asked, holding out a straw he'd pocketed from the bar downstairs. Aaron considered, eyeing the gray line dubiously, but Justin knew she'd refuse. Aaron liked others to take risks for her amusement. She didn't take many risks with herself.
That's all for you, baby.
Justin shrugged and snorted half the line. The rest he scooped up with the credit card and stirred into his vodka and orange juice.
Feel anything?
Aaron asked.
It stings, that's for sure.
He sneezed and wiped his nose, then drank the laced beverage in one long swig.
Well, I guess we'll see. It may not work. You know, it only worked for some of the kids in Perdido Beach. There may be a genetic factor or something.
And then there's the question of the dome.
It'll work for you,
Aaron said with quiet complacency. Of course, Justin knew she was pandering to him, flattering him. But he also knew she was conflicted, had been all along, wanting to hold on to Justin's talent, wanting to maintain at least some control over him, enjoying the dangerous rush of his company, and even, probably, enjoying his lovemaking. but at the same time, she was fascinated by the idea of her young prodigy acquiring powers. She wanted to see that, to be part of that. The artist unbound. At which point, Justin suspected he might no longer need her money. Or her. The possibilities were endless. They had a bare 3 hours of sleep before their respective phone alarms rang. They showered together, with predictable results, and took the shuttle to the airport. They caught the 10 a.m. Delta flight and settled wearily into first-class seats, reclined their chairs, and picked unenthusiastically at an early lunch of swordfish with crayfish garnish before falling asleep. Justin slept like only a 19-year-old can, deeply, totally, effortlessly, waking only in time to hear the captain on the intercom warning of strong crosswinds at LaGuardia that might make for a bit of a bumpy landing, folks. As if on cue, the plane bucked, rising on a gust and then falling too fast, with the sickening sensation of a roller coaster hurtling down from the first big drop. Then, just a few thousand yards from the runway, wheels already down, there came a powerful gust that shoved the plane sideways, knocking Justin's head forward. A startled cry that some might interpret as fear came from Justin's lips, which he then twisted into an ironic smile in hopes that his nervousness would seem to be a joke. It wasn't a joke. The next swerve was positively terrifying, wild enough to cause the drinks cart to break free and slam into a bulkhead. A flight attendant seated in the rear-facing jump seat grabbed it and pinioned it with her feet. Justin had no special fear of flying, but he had a very healthy fear of death and a deep dislike bordering on phobia about being out of control. Adrenaline flooded his arteries, his muscles tensed. He gripped the armrests as if twisting the leather would let him steer the plane. And then, suddenly, Justin's roomy first-class seat wasn't so roomy. It was odd, he thought at first, an illusion, a psychological effect of nervousness. But yes, it was as if the seat was narrowing. Justin's shoulders felt too large, and when he turned his head, his chin actually scraped against a bulbous, massive swelling that rightly belonged on a whole different person, a much larger, much more muscular person. "What the?" Justin blurted. He was blowing up like an inflatable bed, muscles bulging at shoulders, thighs, arms, all of him growing. His seatbelt stretched and then snapped. "What's happening?" he cried, snatching at the broken seatbelt with fingers that were not right, not right at all. He screamed. The pilot fought the crosswind, and the plane rocked from side to side as they skimmed above Brooklyn. The engine surged and faded, surged and faded. Justin caught a glimpse of a cemetery just below them. "Justin!" Aaron cried suddenly, staring at him, mouth open, shying away from him as far as her own seatbelt would allow. You're, what? What? He cried, and now it was his voice that was not right. Not his voice at all. His voice had become this huge thing, deeper, more masculine, gravelly. He sounded like some weird cross between Vin Diesel and Darth Vader. "Look at your face! Look at your face!" Aaron practically screamed. But of course, he couldn't. He couldn't look at his own face, but he could see that the rest of him was becoming something very different. It was almost impossible to believe that it was him. Madness to look down at your own body, hands, feet, and not recognize them. "My God, it's happening," he said in that voice like truck wheels going over wet gravel. "It's happening."
Does it hurt, baby? Does it hurt?"
Aaron squeaked. She looked 10 years older with her face distorted by fear.
Just weird, I," Justin said.
And still, he grew, swelled, thickened, his legs masses of bunched muscle. His black jeans tore, rip, and exposed limbs that looked like armor, like naked bone, like shell, like the hard chitin that formed a lobster's shell. Tiny pricks, wicked little rose thorns rose from the armor that covered his legs and now arms. Snap! The armrest broke off. Aaron screamed, words all gone, in full panic now, and she yanked off her own seatbelt and fell on her rear end in the aisle, legs pistoning, trying to escape being crushed. The flight attendant seated in the rear-facing jump seat said, "Ma'am, return to your..." Before she froze, mid-word, eyes bulging in horror, jaw trembling as she saw Justin. They were seconds from touching down when the fingers of Justin's still human right hand melted together and he cried out in gibbering terror. His right hand no longer had fingers, no longer had a wrist. It was a spear, a sword, dirty blue and coral in color. And it was growing. "This is not what I wanted. I wanted to shoot light beams." Even his terrified mind was ashamed of that juvenile complaint. It was working. He was morphing into something very different. He was becoming Art. As the sword arm grew, his left hand thickened, and it split in half, split bloodlessly wide open between middle and ring finger, forming a hideous lobster-like pincer that swelled until it must have weighed 50 pounds all by itself. Justin whinnied in terror. "It ought to hurt," some small still-aware part of his mind knew. "It ought to be agony." But it was not painful. Not really. Just mind-bending. Insane. Impossible. Impossible! But all the while, his right hand, the sword, kept growing, growing, the melted fingers flattening first into something like a boat's paddle that thinned at the edges and glittered as it became, unmistakably, a blade. Now, with startling speed, Justin's blade hand grew outward, longer and longer till the blade tip sliced straight through the side of the cabin, ripping the aluminum flesh of the plane just below the window as if it were no more substantial than a paper bag. "Ah!" Justin's bladder emptied into his ripped jeans, but that was the least of his concerns. The window cracked and blew out. A hurricane of cold wind rushed in, grabbing in-flight magazines and menus and whirling them around the cabin. And now came more screams, screams of disbelieving panic as everyone in the first-class compartment saw and lurched up from their seats and backed away toward the cockpit or down the aisle into coach, piling over one another while the jet shuddered and rocked violently. Everyone was in a panic, rushing to get away, staggering, slipping, shouting. Everyone but the elderly couple seated just ahead of Justin and Aaron, who were either asleep or amazingly oblivious. Justin tried to draw his sword hand back, but it was too long. Not my fault. Too long to fit inside the plane. And instead of retracting, that blue and coral blade sliced upward. Not my fault. Ripped effortlessly through the molded plastic and the aluminum outer skin of the plane, ripped up through the overhead luggage compartment, bisecting carry-on bags, and the plane lurched more wildly than ever, and an appalled Justin, "Not my fault," saw that the cut he'd made was widening. An inch, 2 inches, three. The plane was breaking apart, and in a few more seconds, the rear 70% of the plane would break off, and they would all die in a fiery crash. "And people will say it's my fault, but it's not. I didn't ask for this." The wheels touched tarmac with a rubber squeal. The plane bounded, slewed sideways, bounced again, screams and screams and screams all the while, and Justin screaming too, and Aaron knocked into the now empty seats across the aisle, staring at him with eyes so wide her pupils were just dots surrounded by white. And then, miraculously, the plane was rolling on all three wheels, rolling down the tarmac. But the screaming did not stop, because now they all knew that a monster was among them, a nightmare creature who rose from his seat, head scraping the ceiling. He turned heedlessly to look back at the passengers and swept his blade hand forward, slicing through the seat ahead and the elderly couple occupying those seats. "Not my fault." The blade cut through their chests and the tops of their bodies, from mid-chest upward, toppled off, landing with a wet and heavy impact, like cattle in a slaughterhouse. Nothing but slabs of meat. Blood and gore bubbled up from their torsos, and in pure panic now, seeing what he had done. "Not my fault." Not knowing what else to do, Justin surged toward the exit door, but his blade swept on, slicing through the galley, through the bathroom, and through the back of the cockpit, and suddenly, there were no controls, and quite likely, though Justin could not see for sure, no pilots either. The plane was rolling too fast. The reverse thrusters had not been engaged, and with no one steering, the jet veered wildly off the runway, careening with unstoppable momentum toward the terminal building and fiery destruction. It was then that Justin's mind cleared enough to see what he must do. He swept his blade upward, cutting through the ceiling, and continued on, cutting a jagged path around the circumference of the fuselage, until, with a deafening screech of tortured metal, the front of the plane fell away. Justin saw the terrified eyes of the flight attendant still buckled into her jump seat as she was carried off with the cockpit section. The cockpit section slewed right, tumbled madly, turned again and again, sparks everywhere, and was struck by the right wing, which sheared off from the impact, spraying jet fuel over the runway. The right side jet engine snapped off the broken wing and cartwheeled fantastically, bounding away like a living thing, still running on the last of its fuel. The main body of the plane slumped hard to its right, as the wheel on that side had been carried away with the wing. Erin tumbled into Justin, and her wrist was stabbed by one of his thorns, but he caught her in the crook of his arm. The fuselage, now skidding on its side, bucked and vibrated with an end-of-the-world sound of ripping aluminum and carbon fiber, the lower edge chewing and sparking along the tarmac. The forward momentum that would have slammed them into the terminal at a deadly speed bled off, and the fuselage stopped suddenly, sending loose luggage and unbelted passengers flying forward. Just above them, not 50 feet away, faces pressed to the glass of the terminal windows, stared down with mouths open. And then, silence. Silence as everything, including the remaining engine, stopped. Dust and smoke filled the air. The fuselage was cantilevered, the broken front down, the bent and twisted tail up, the entirety lying half on its right side, with the remaining left wing soaring up and away at an angle. Justin stood at the front of the plane, his now massive shape filling the open circle where once the plane had had a front. His feet were the claws of a T-Rex. His shoulders were chitin-armored boulders. His head was 5 times its normal size. His flesh was hard and shining dully. His hands, a massive pincer and an unwieldy blade, were blue and coral. His body, where exposed, was the sickly white of a trout's belly.
"We have to get out of here," Erin cried.
She'd lost both her shoes, her hair was a mess, and her face was smeared with tears and the blood and gore of the elderly couple.
"Listen to me, we can't stay here," Erin screeched. "We have to get away, you've killed people."
Her hand gripped his thick, inhuman forearm, then recoiled from touching him. Justin could feel that his face, the face he had not yet seen, was not good at expressing emotion. He did not seem to have lips quite where they should be, and his tongue was like something you might cut out of an ox. He was scared, stunned, overwhelmed. But even in the midst of that flood of emotion, he sensed something. Something dark and distant, yet right there inside his brain, something that was watching him. He shook off that thought and forced himself to recognize and accept what Erin was saying. He had probably killed the pilots and the flight attendant. He had certainly killed the old couple. He hadn't meant to, not my fault. But they were dead just the same, and he was looking at their torsos, sagging ovals of exposed organs and hanging viscera, still buckled in. Even now, even amid the rising chorus of screams joined by cries of pain, even in the swirling midst of his own impossible nightmare, some part of Justin wished he had a camera. There was a terrible, gruesome beauty to all of it. The bodies, the gore, the impossible angles, the swirling dust, shirts and underwear, the contents of carry-on bags, draped over seatbacks like some demented granny's idea of doilies. A beautiful annihilation. A new note could be heard in the screams, the beginnings of rage to join the horror. Justin saw staring eyes, animal fear in bulging eyes, pointing fingers, mouths open in shock and disgust, and all of it turning to fury against him. And there were cell phone cameras. Justin grabbed Erin around her waist, careful, so careful with the pincer hand that looked as if it could snap her in two. He lifted her insignificant weight and hopped down to the tarmac. Effortless. His claw feet gripped the tarmac, sinking into it like bare toes in mud. The smell of jet fuel was all around. The emergency slide unfolded from a rear door, and in seconds the people on the plane would get free of the wreck. The people. And their cell phones.
Lighter,
Justin said in that harsh, deep, reverberating voice.
What? Give me your lighter. Now.
Erin fumbled in her clutch purse, spilled out a bottle of pills, a pack of foreign cigarettes, a tampon, and came up with the lighter, holding it out for him, and he cursed.
My hand is... You have to do it.
Do what? She demanded, desperate just to get away, to run, to hide, to find a place that would serve her enough alcohol to somehow wipe the nightmare from her mind.
Witnesses,
Justin said coldly. And in his mind, he felt an unsettling pleasure, because now was his time. Now, the clear, direct, emotionless reptile that had always been a part of him saw clearly what Erin could not, or would not. The first of the passengers were sliding down the inflated ramp. The ramp was at a too steep angle, and a woman fell off halfway down, landing bruised, but alive on the runway. It took Erin a few seconds to understand what Justin was saying, what he was demanding.
No, no, no. I can't.
Justin's massive claw now closed again around her midriff, and the message was clear. Do it. Do it. With trembling fingers, Erin flicked the lighter, a spark, a flame. Justin used his massive claw to rip her dress, tearing off a long shred, which hung like a limp flag from his pincer.
Light it.
Shaking so violently, she nearly dropped the lighter. Erin set fire to the swatch of fabric. A passenger saw and shouted, No, you idiot! There's jet fuel everywhere!
Yeah,
Justin rumbled.
I noticed.
He tossed the flaming fabric into the shallow pool of fuel that edged toward his claw feet. Jet fuel is kerosene, and kerosene does not catch fire as quickly as gasoline. The fabric burned blue as Justin threw Erin over one massive shoulder and turned to run, run, run. And behind them came the screams and shouts of fire, fire. Justin ran, great bounding leaps, 20 feet with each step. Each impact ripping the concrete, ran away from the terminal and across the runway, kicking heedlessly through landing lights, passing beneath the nose of a taxiing FedEx plane, racing in panic toward the fenced perimeter of the airport as the flames spread and the smoke billowed and the screams of the doomed chased him. And the dark watchers laughed silently. Chapter 5. A Perfect Specimen. Armo, a name formed by rearranging his true name, Aristotle Adamo, was a white male, 17, 6'5" tall, muscular, blonde, blue-eyed, with a jawline Michelangelo would have wished he could sculpt. By his own admission, Armo was not what you would call an academic sort, 1.7 GPA. But neither was he a jock, despite being heavily recruited by his high school's basketball team, football team, and even water polo team. He was also not a gamer, a surfer, a geek, a nerd, or member of any other sort of group. Chess club? No. Math club? Ha! Armo's math skills ended at long division and fractions. Cheese tasting club? Definitely not. Armo was not part of any clique because there was one, only one Armo, at Malibu High School. MHS was neck deep in the beautiful children of Hollywood, but still there was only one Armo. There was not a straight girl or gay boy at MHS who had not looked longingly after him. He was gorgeous, and worse than that, charismatic, and worst of all, he knew it, accepted it as natural, and didn't care. His self-confidence went deep down to the bone. ODD. The counselor read from the sheet of paper on his desk.
Odd?
Armo asked. Oppositional defiant disorder. That's what the shrink, the psyche, Val said. You're smart enough to manage at least a C-plus average without trying, and a B if you worked at it. Maybe you won't be going to Harvard, but you could go to a decent state school, make something of yourself.
I'm already something, Armo said complacently.
The counselor, a sad brown mouse of a man, could not, despite his best efforts, avoid feeling himself to be something out of DNA's recycling bin by comparison with the young god lounging in the too small chair. The counselor sighed and thought, "You may be a pain in the ass, but at least you'll never lack for female and or male companionship." "Why don't you take Spanish? You know you need a language credit to graduate."
"I don't want to take Spanish. I want to take Danish. My family is Danish."
"We do not offer Danish as a language option." Armo shrugged. The counselor said, "You understand that everyone in Denmark speaks English, right? Usually better than most Americans?" A faint smile twisted the corner of Armo's lips. "This is why it's important to keep Danish alive. It's my heritage."
"Okay." The counselor laid his hands palm down on his desk in a gesture that signaled surrender.
"Okay, Armo, but you won't graduate. And if you don't graduate, you won't go to college."
"Yeah. And that will make it very difficult for you to get a decent job."
"Like school counselor?" Armo's face was blank, but there was a spark in his blue eyes, and despite the implied insult, despite the brick wall refusal to go along with, well, anything, the counselor found himself smiling.
"That shut him up," Armo thought.
"Can I take off now?" Armo asked, and 30 seconds later, he was back out on campus, striding to the parking lot as the churning mass of students rushing between classes parted before him like the Red Sea before Moses. The parking lot was a sea of BMWs, Mercedes, and Teslas. There were also, at the other end of the spectrum, numerous Priuses and Leafs. But there was only one beat-up orange and white 2003 Dodge Viper. Many of the cars of the rich kids at Malibu High were fast, but only one did 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds, with a top speed of 189.5 miles per hour and made the earth shake from the throaty rumble of the Viper's enormous engine. No one but an idiot gave a 17-year-old a car that fast, but fortunately for Armo, his father was a former stuntman who had managed to become an action movie star. His father figured if Fast and Furious was good for him, it would surely be good for his son as well. The Viper's cloth top was down, and Armo hopped smoothly over the door and dropped onto the cracked leather seat. This right here, this moment, when he was in his car, when he was done with school for the day, with the sun shining and the ocean sparkling, this was his favorite part of the day. He loved this moment. He looked forward all through the tedious day to this moment, the moment of escape, of freedom. He keyed the accelerator and felt the 8.3-liter, 500-horsepower engine come to life, startling a pair of seagulls into dropping the French fry they'd been fighting over. Armo roared down Morning View Drive, pulled onto the Pacific Coast Highway, and was hit so hard by a gasoline tanker truck that the Viper went airborne for 50 feet, spinning in midair as Armo thought, "Uh-oh, that was a mistake." The Viper landed on the far side of the PCH, bounced over the low metal railing that fronted the beach, and came to rest upside down on the sand, knocking a 3-inch crack into Armo's thick skull. For a long time, a very long time, Armo saw, smelled, tasted, and heard nothing. Nothing. A very long nothing. And then, a sound. Meaningless, but something rather than the nothing. 2 days after that single sound, Armo opened his eyes and saw blurry figures. The next day he opened his eyes again and saw a man's face. There was something familiar about the face, but he couldn't place it. Just vague, distorted memories of previous brief emergences into consciousness. His grip on awareness was still extremely weak, in and out, with no way to know how much time passed between each brief contact with reality. The next day, he opened his eyes again and said, "Water." "Your fluids are in your IV," a male voice said. "You were in a medical facility. Your injuries are healing nicely."
"What?"
"I'm Dr. Park. You are safe. You are in a medical facility," that blandly comforting voice said. Armo squinted and sort of saw the doctor,
a plain-looking, middle-aged Asian man with graying hair. You're going to be all right.
A damn sight better than all right.
A female voice with a hint of the old South said, but he'd have to turn his head to see her, and found he couldn't quite do that. Tomorrow we'll get that neck brace off you and try some liquids, Dr. Park said, and Armo went back to sleep. The woman's voice said, one more day, Park, then he's mine. The next day, Armo was feeling much better. He could see clearly, though the dull beige hospital room was nothing much to look at. He saw himself, most of himself, stretched out under a white sheet. He tried to move a leg, and it moved. Tried to move the other leg, and it ached, but it, too, was still attached. Hands? There they were, right in front of his face, and he could count to 10 on his fingers.
So, how are we today?
Dr. Park bustled into the room. Water? The doctor poured some from a plastic jug into a paper cup and held it to Armo's parched lips. The pleasure was exquisite.
What happened to me?
Armo asked.
Well, you had a disagreement with a tanker truck.
Broken leg, broken collarbone, multiple contusions and abrasions, the most serious matter being a cracked skull.
Is my...
Armo pointed with awkward fingers at his crotch. Yes, your penis and testicles are undamaged. Dr. Park rolled his eyes. Armo sighed relief.
My car?
Totaled, I'm afraid. Armo fought back tears.
Is my mom or dad here?
We'll talk about all that later, Dr. Park said. He did something with a small toggle on the clear plastic line that ran into the veins of Armo's wrist, and a wave of weariness flooded him. Armo closed his eyes, but he did not lose consciousness. Dr. Park was not an anesthesiologist, and gave him a dose that would put a normal-sized person under. But Armo was not a normal-sized person. Armo listened as a second person walked in. He'd heard this voice before. The tense female voice out of the South. The last time, it had said, a damn sight better than all right.
How's our patient?
Much better. The leg fracture is almost completely healed. The skull fracture is knitting up well. His vitals are steady. In fact, so he'll...